Hi, how you doing?
I'm great.
Yeah?
Yeah, we were just looking at hilarious things, and there are more hilarious
Yes.
things for people to see on the
On
Patreon.
the Patreon.
It's patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Get into it.
Hi,
Hi,
everyone.
and welcome to
The
the
Bitchery
Bitchery
of
of History.
History.
My name is Max,
I'm Allison.
and this week I'm going to be talking about Hannah Sheehy Skeffington.
Ooh, sounds good.
Yes.
And she was a special request from a listener, wasn't she?
She was requested by Sinead Crilly on Facebook.
And I am going to be doing Madame de Lafayette. Lafayette. Not that one.
No.
She was born Marie Madeleine Pioche de Lavanne in Paris, France.
Okay.
So, pretty good French name right there.
Yeah.
But she's better known as Madame de Lafayette. She was born into a family of minor but wealthy nobility, and at 16, she was actually the maid of honor to Queen Anne of Austria.
Whoa.
And it's around this time that she began to gain a literary education from Gilles Meneng, who gave her lessons in Italian and Latin. And it was through these lessons that she joined the fashionable salons of Madame de Rambouillet and Madame Madeleine de Scuderi. Both of these women, like Lafayette, would become important fixtures in French writing. Her father passed away when she was 15, and her mother remarried to René de Sévigné, who was the uncle of Madame de Sévigné, an aristocrat who would also become known later on for her beautiful letter writing. So
Oh,
she's just surrounded by a lot of
yeah,
these
absolutely.
writers. And Lafayette and Madame de Sévigné remained lifelong friends. In 1655, when she was 21, she married Francis Moitier, Comte de Lafayette. He was a widowed nobleman who was 18 years older than her. They would have two sons together, so
Great.
apparently had a decently happy marriage. She would travel to other parts of France with him, but for the most part, she remained in Paris, where she mixed with court society and formed her own successful salon.
Oh, cool.
Now, for those listeners who might not know, salons are kind of like artsy musical book clubs. Like, people would get together at someone's house, which isn't like your house. When I say house, I mean like Downton Abbey house,
Right.
and
Like an
have,
estate.
right, at the estate, and have poetry readings and musical recitals and just lots of sort of free-flowing art and literature and presumably food and wine and bread and cheese and all the good French things. She acquired many other high society acquaintances, including the future Duchess of Orleans and several other female writers. In 1659, she and her husband had a separation of sorts because he preferred leading a quiet life in the country and she liked staying in Paris where her literary friends lived. But, you know, it's not like they got a divorce. They just lived separate lives, which not too uncommon at the time.
Yeah. Plus, this is
As
France. They're a lot more liberal with their relationship
Of course.
views.
So, as far as I understand it, it's not that it was an unhappy situation. They just wanted to do different
That is so healthy, honestly.
things. There's actually scientific research that proves that if you sleep in separate beds, you both sleep better.
I've heard that too.
And every couple I've ever said that to, including my dad, goes, "That's just not true. Like, of course I sleep better when your mom's in the bed. That's ridiculous." And I'm like, "No.
All right.
Not what the science says. You might think that you sleep better because
Right,
you're
right,
happier, but you don't." In 1662, Lafayette published anonymously La Princesse de Montpensier, a short story of an adulterous love affair where the heroine falls in love with someone other than her husband.
Oh.
This
Scandal.
theme of violent passion and jealousy would be her signature in most of her stories. In 1669, a first volume of a Hispano-Moorish romance was released called Zaid. It was signed by the French poet Jean Renault de Sagrée, but many attribute it to Lafayette. The second volume came out and it got many reprints and translations, but this is also partly because French scholar Pierre Huet wrote the preface. So,
Okay,
came out much,
cool.
much later in 1971, but there are other various and sundry reasons as to why.
Right.
Now, in 1665, she formed a friendship with writer François de la Rochefoucauld, who also bore the title Prince de Marcellac.
Okay.
And it seems like their relationship was platonic, but there's hints that they had an affair.
Sure.
You know, her husband's away. She had a hand in correcting his famous writings, Maximes, which consisted of over 500 of his reflections on the conduct and motives of mankind.
Wow.
And he influenced her novel, La Princesse de Clèves.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her most famous novel, which she also published anonymously in March 1678. It's considered the beginning of the modern tradition of the psychological novel.
Oh.
And is a classic.
Yes.
It is also often referred to as the single most important novel of the century.
Whoa.
And I have never heard of it once.
Get on it. Read it and tell me about it.
Maybe we can get it on Audible.
Yes. Audibletrial.com/bitchery.
The story takes place. It actually sounds fairly interesting. The story takes place in the French court in the mid-1500s, about 100 years prior to when it was actually published. And it tells the story of a young heiress who marries a prince, but shortly after falls in love with a duke and is torn between duty and her feelings.
Oh.
And when the duke has a hunch that his wife loves someone else, he confronts her about it and she tells him the truth. The prince falls ill and on his deathbed asks her not to marry the duke when he is dead. The duke continues to pursue her after the prince's death, but she rejects him and joins a convent. The duke's love for her fades, and she passes away into obscurity.
Oh, my.
What a roller coaster.
What a story.
Two quotes from the book to share.
Okay.
If you judge by appearances in this place, said Madame de Chartres, you will often be deceived, because what appears to be the case hardly ever is.
Mm.
And, quote, my thoughts are violent and uncertain, and I am not able to control them. I no longer think myself worthy of you, nor do I think you are worthy of me. I adore you. I hate you. I offend you. I ask your pardon. I admire you. I blush for my admiration. In a word, I have nothing of tranquility or reason left about me.
Oh, my God.
Woo! Girl's got it bad. She got the vapors. Woo!
So do I.
This novel is seen as an accurate image of the closed universe of nobility in the late 17th century of Versailles.
Uh-huh.
And the interest in the story depends not just on the incident, you know, the plot,
sure,
but on the characters within it. They act in a perfectly reasonable way and their motives are analyzed with the finest discrimination. So what made her writing so revolutionary and such a change from French novels of the time was that her description and her prose was more concise,
mm-hmm,
than the extravagance of what had come before her. And she had a very cold, rational vision of love instead of being fanciful and romantic. As time passed, her authorship of these various works have been questioned, especially since she published them anonymously and they're partially attributed to male writers she kept company with.
Sure.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah,
but it is
blah,
widely
blah.
Accepted that she was the original author. There are also some arguments over the different English translations that have come out in the 20th century. One translation, a woman, Joan Dejean, has criticized the translations by men because they get rid of the book's female agency.
Mm.
She said, quote, today, no truly reliable edition of the novel exists, and that it is high time we put Lafayette back in charge of her princess's story.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Of course.
I'm going to be talking about Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. She was born Johanna Mary Hannah Sheehy on May 24th, 1877 in Kanturk, County Cork.
And that's in Ireland?
Which is in Ireland.
Is this our first Irish woman?
You know, I think it might be.
I feel like it is.
Yes. And she was requested by Sinead Crilly. And Sinead is an Irish name.
It is. Let's dig more into the Green Isle, folks.
Yes, ma'am. Hannah was the firstborn of Elizabeth Bessie McCoy and David Sheehy, an ex-Fenian and an MP for the Irish Parliamentary Party representing South Galway.
Hmm.
When she was three, they relocated to Loughmore, Tipperary. And Hannah had six siblings when her father became an MP in 1887. They actually moved to Dublin when he became an MP, and they lived right next door to the Lord Mayor of Dublin.
Whoa.
His name was T.D. Sullivan.
That's cool.
When she was 18 years old, Hannah was sent to Germany to get treated for tuberculosis, which was successful, thankfully.
Good.
Her brother Richard was close friends with James Joyce, and he actually wrote about the family in his novel Ulysses.
Whoa!
Which, if you don't know, is the longest sentence, I believe, in...
I believe it.
It's Ulysses.
It's the longest everything.
The whole book is one sentence.
I just knew it was long. I didn't know it was one... I can't do that.
That's what I've heard. I could be wrong.
Audible?
But that's what I've heard. Maybe. Okay. James Joyce is actually the one who introduced Hannah to her future husband, Francis Skeffington. She attended school at St. Mary's University College, a women's college, and studied modern languages, specifically French and German, and received her Bachelor of Arts degree from the Royal University of Ireland in 1899 and a Master of Arts degree with first class honors in 1902. She married Francis Skeffington on June 3rd, 1903, and they wore their graduation gowns instead of traditional wedding gown and suit.
Aww.
Here's the really cute part. They both changed their last names in 1903 to Sheehy Skeffington as a symbol of their honor for one another, which did not please his family.
It's fine. Do you have a tissue or something? But like, it's fine.
Francis himself was actually seen as controversial in general at the time because of the way he let his unkempt beard grow. And he actually wore a badge on his coats that said votes for women in 1903.
I love him.
I love him. So a suffragette and an Irish nationalist, Hannah was raised as a Republican and became more active politically after school. It's interesting, though, because her father actually consistently voted against women's suffrage bills, which gave Hannah insight into the extent of which women were marginalized. So it gave her like a view onto the other side.
Yep.
In 1908, with her husband, Francis, she founded the Irish Women's Franchise League, along with Margaret Cousins and James Cousins. Their aim was obtaining voting rights for women. Along with this, she also founded the publication The Irish Citizen with Frances. It was an 8-page weekly newspaper, and within the first month of its publication, had sold 3,000 copies and was reaching up to 10,000 readers.
Whoa.
The motto was, for men and women equally the rights of citizenship, for men and women equally the duties of citizenship.
I want a movie.
Me too.
I'm in love. I want everything.
They began with only 12 members, but it quickly grew to become one of the largest suffragette groups that existed in Ireland in the early 20th century, excuse me. It is described as a militant organization that focused on trying to fight issues like Irish independence and the exclusion of women from the voting process and the absence of women's rights in general. They had meetings on a weekly basis in Dublin's Phoenix Park and organized rallies throughout the country. According to co-founder Margaret Cousins, they were met with much hostility, but membership continued to grow. In 1911, she was one of the founding members of the Irish Women's Workers' Union, an autonomous branch of a general Irish workers' union. And then on June 13th, 1912, Hannah, along with 7 other women, were arrested for smashing the glass windows of Dublin Castle.
Whoa!
This was in reaction to the exclusion of women from the franchise of the Third Home Rule Bill. She was convicted a week later with fellow suffragettes Margaret Palmer and Jane and Margaret Murphy, and they served a month-long sentence. And then after refusing to pay the fine that came with their prison sentence, they served another month in prison for not paying the fine. This starts a long kind of trend of Margaret going to jail for things that she believed in.
As did many, many women.
Exactly. Absolutely.
During the suffragette movement.
In 1913, she attempted to present leaflets to the conservative leader Bonar Law, and doing so, she assaulted one of them and was sent to prison yet again.
She was
sent on a hunger strike for 5 days until she was released. Right after this, she was fired from her job at Rothman's School of Commerce for her continued involvement in, quote, feminist militancy. She strongly opposed participating in the First World War and was actually prevented by the British government from attending the International Congress of Women in April 1915.
Whoa.
A few months later in June, her husband now was imprisoned for anti-recruiting activities.
Talk about a progressive couple.
Seriously. I could only hope to find a relationship like this. It's amazing. A slight pause on this to tell you a little bit about Irish history. So the Easter Rising. The Easter Rising is a name given to the rebellion against the occupying British government in Ireland on Easter Monday, 1916. Around 1,600 rebels seized strategic buildings within Dublin, but it didn't garner the support for the public that the rebels had hoped.
Mm.
So fighting went on for a few days, but the British ultimately won. During the fighting, about 450 people were killed, 2,000 people were injured, And the 15 leaders of the rebellion were executed by firing squad.
Oy.
So Hannah was actually in favor of this rebellion, and she even helped rebellion fighters by bringing them food and supplies. Francis, however, was against it, And while Hannah was out helping deliver messages between the rebels, Francis decided to take action himself by organizing a militia to stop the looting in Dublin and try to restore some order to the city. The two both went out during the rebellion on Tuesday, and on his way home, Francis was arrested by the British. He was held with two journalists without a charge, and on Wednesday morning, they were all shot. So Francis was killed.
Oh, no.
Hannah actually didn't find out about his death until 2 days after the fact, and she was refused compensation for it. The British captain who gave the order to have Francis killed, Captain Bowen Colhertz, tried to cover up the murder, actually, but an investigation was done, and he was actually found to be insane and was sent to Canada for treatment.
Holy...
I mean, what? For me, that feels a little bit
holy
like...
Holy buckets!
That feels a little bit like what the Catholic Church does with the whole... moving priests around to keep them from assaulting
kids.
Yeah,
just go to Canada.
It's like,
that's
fine. Oh, he's just a little crazy. Go to Canada. You'll be fine.
There's a lot of bears. Go play with the polar bears.
So after this, alongside other suffragettes, Maud Gonne and Charlotte Depard, Hannah helped establish the Women's Prisoners Defense League to campaign and fundraise for over 7,000 Republicans who were imprisoned as a consequence of the Irish Civil War. She published a pamphlet called British Militarism as I've Known It, which was actually banned in the United Kingdom until after World War I.
Whoa!
She aligned herself with Sinn Féin, a Republican political party, in December 1916, and she went to the U.S. on behalf of Sinn Féin to talk about the fight for Irish independence. She attended 250 meetings on this trip and became the only person to make a direct appeal to President Woodrow Wilson for the self-determination of Ireland. She's actually the only Irish nationalist who was granted an audience with the president.
Wow.
Right? That is amazing. Wilson wasn't necessarily against Irish independence, but America was about to be pulled into World War One, and
right,
he really wasn't entirely concerned with the issue.
Oy.
Fun fact, while she was in America, she was actually followed by both U.S. and British intelligence, by the Secret Service, and all of her activity was reported on and kept track of.
Wow.
Because Sinn Féin is regarded in Britain as a terrorist organization. She was not legally allowed to enter back into Ireland after this trip because her passport had been voided. But she snuck onto a steamship heading to Dublin and got home anyways. She was revealed within a week and was actually arrested and sent to prison in England yet again. She went on a hunger strike, and after 2 days, she was released based on a very strange rule that basically said suffragettes on hunger strike would be released if they fall ill, but then were rearrested when they were well again. This is called the Cat and Mouse Act. And it's actually a law that used to exist. So when they would go on hunger strikes, instead of trying to keep them alive, they would release them. And then once they got better, the police were supposed to go by and round them all up again.
Rearrest them.
However,
only slightly better than force feeding.
Exactly. However, she escaped. They let her out. She went right back to Ireland. In July 1926, she attended the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom alongside 21 other Irish delegates. The president of the league, Jane Addams, praised the bravery of Hannah's husband, and she also attended the conference in Prague later that same year. She was arrested again in January 1933 in Newry, this time for breaching an exclusion order banning her from Northern Ireland. She'd actually gone to speak on behalf of the female Republican prisoners being held in a jail up there. And she said, quote, "I recognize no partition. I recognize it as no crime to be in my own country. I would be ashamed of my own name and my murdered husband's name if I did. Long live the Republic." She was sentenced to a month's imprisonment.
Oh, forget a movie. I want an HBO series. Oh, my God.
In 1935, she speaks out against the Conditions of Employment Bill on behalf of the Women's Graduates Associates, which was set to restrict the opportunities of employment for women. She was a founding member in 1937 of the Women's Social and Progressive League, which had the goal of informing women of the consequence of anti-women legislation. In 1943, she stood for the Dáil, which is the lower house and principal chamber of the Irish legislature, at the age of 66 years old, but lost, unfortunately. And then 3 years later, in 1968, she passed away. She was buried in Glasnevin Cemetery with her husband. Her son, Owen Sheehy Skeffington became a politician and an Irish senator.
Wowza. I can't believe we haven't done her yet.
Right?
I can't believe it's taken us this long to find this story.
Honestly, thank you so much, Sinead. This is an
For
amazing
real,
woman.
This is incredible. And this is why we do the podcast.
Absolutely.
Honestly,
absolutely.
Is because I'm sitting here, I'm just blown away. Her story just goes on and on and on. And she never gives up. She never stops. Her courage has no end.
I do not see it as a crime to be in my own country.
Ugh.
It is amazing. She really, truly is a badass bitch.
Little wedding and their graduation gowns.
Oh,
it's so cute.
Such a cute couple. Such an amazing and very like forward-thinking and progressive couple.
Hugely progressive couple. Just an incredible story.
I like
to
think that I would be wearing a button in 1903 that said votes for women. I like to think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could have been born into different circumstances, but I like to think I would have.
Yeah, I agree.
I know you would have.
Yeah, but the question I ask myself is, how would I have felt about slavery?
Because
I'm from the South, and I'm like, I would like to think that I would be against
it. That's true.
But if that was the society
and the culture you'd grown up in.
And the culture that I was born into and that I grew up in.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, hypotheticals.
Speaking of, I don't know, making judgments or asking yourself hard questions. One of the books that we haven't recommended yet from our amazing partners at audible.com is To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee.
Yes.
And it's fabulous. You can get that book and hundreds of others at audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hey, y'all. If you're enjoying the podcast, you know what to do. Look down at that phone, look down at that computer you're listening to us on, and give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music,
Blueberry,
Stitcher, Blueberry,
Raspberry,
wherever you're listening to the podcast.
Blackberry, Halle Berry.
Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. And I know you want that.
Thanks. Today in history?
Yes, ma'am.
On June 20th, 1837, Queen Victoria ascended to the British throne. She would reign for 63 years and 7 months, the longest to date. She's incredible. We should do her as
Honestly,
well.
Honestly, yeah. We could do like an entire episode on.
Yeah.
And then on June 21st, 1957, Ellen Fairclough is sworn in as Canada's first woman cabinet minister.
Lovely.
And now we have Justin Trudeau with half and half.
Apparently. Oh, you were there that he uploaded a whole Instagram album of him and puppies or something. Is he just trying to get everyone to defect to Canada?
I'll do it.
On June 22nd, 1813, Laura Secord sets out to walk 20 miles to warn Canadian troops of an impending attack by the Americans.
It's like Paul Revere, but for the Canadians. And instead of the British, it's the Americans.
And instead of a horse, you have to walk. That's incredible.
We should look her up.
We should.
So what's our term for the week, Allison?
Our term for the week is girl in the refrigerator.
Yes.
Do you know what it means?
I do.
You want to explain it?
So girl in the refrigerator is a kind of like a trope in comic books where a girl or a woman is used to further the character growth of a male character.
And typically it's by them either being murdered or raped or dehumanized
in some way.
And then the man is like, haha, I must become a hero now.
Exactly.
And yes, it originated in comics and in speaking about comic books. But it's a trope that you can kind of see in a lot of other forms of media, television shows and movies and books as well. There was an article a few years ago in Entertainment Weekly that was about why it sort of similarly, not only about, you know, furthering male plots, but why is the only way to make a female character storyline interesting to have her be raped?
Right.
They were talking specifically about one of the seasons of Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no spoilers. I won't say who it is, but they were just kind
right.
of saying there are so many other cool things that we could have explored with that character. And that,
right.
that's the biggest challenge. So just saying, you know, women can do cool stuff too.
Right.
And or have our own plots.
And I think there, I don't think that this is saying that women can't die and get raped right. and be assaulted. It's saying if the purpose of it is to further the man, the man's character, the, or
a, the male plot or the main plot of
then,
anything.
Then that is where the problem right. lies. Because there are a million different ways to further a plot yes. without hurting a woman.
If you need someone to know information, hand them a phone.
Exactly.
It's a paraphrase of Alfred Hitchcock.
The most recent, at least the most visible one that I'd heard of, mm-hmm. where I'd actually heard, this is where I actually learned about this phrase.
Oh,
the,
sure.
The girl in the refrigerator.
Right.
Was when the last Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield came out. And I'm going to feel safe saying that these aren't spoilers anymore because that movie came out like
sure. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but go for it.
So the the
Gwen Stacy
is killed. So the character played by Emma Stone, right at the end, is killed. She falls from like a very large tower, and Spider-Man Andrew Garfield is like falling at the same time. It's literally right at the end of the movie, and he catches her just in time for her to hit the ground and then be like slightly suspended. And so she dies. For really
no reason.
No reason.
They don't even make another Spider-Man movie.
Not with him, at least.
And not with that storyline.
What I'd heard, and this is like from the people who are like Spider-Man enthusiasts, is that in the comic books, she is killed because him growing from that leads to Mary Jane and meeting the Mary Jane character. But I have problems with that. I don't know if I'm okay with a woman, with one woman dying so that he can grow and meet Mary Jane eventually. Or I don't know that I'm okay with his ability as a superhero being dependent on the fact that his...
Now, I think I've talked about this book before, Red Rising by Pierce Brown. It's great. You can also get it on Audible. I lent it to a friend and she stopped reading and she said, I can't do any more girl in the refrigerator trope because his wife is killed very early in the plot. Mm-hmm. It's not even really a spoiler. It's maybe chapter two. And he then does sort of grow and does eventually meet this other girl.
Right.
However, his wife, who was hung by an oppressive regime, and it's a whole sci-fi thing, eventually grows from being just his wife who was killed to being a symbol for this whole rebellion.
Oh,
you see her face on billboards everywhere.
Right.
You know, she echoes within the plot, not just of his plot, but in the plot of the whole society.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of said, you know, I get where you're coming from, but sometimes the plot has to be that way.
Right.
Because it's the plot and it's not just furthering his story. It's truly furthering the story of the entire society and starting a war.
If the woman dying and then she's used as a symbol, then that is a transformation of the woman herself. So she's not just dying and then she disappears and
we never hear from her
again.
About her and she is referenced continually. So it's a good trope to be aware of, but don't let it ruin all things for you.
Do we know where the phrase, the woman in the refrigerator, comes from?
Yeah. It's actually, it was a website created in 1999. It was created by a group of feminist and comic book fans talking about this comic book trope.
Mm-hmm.
And the website features a list of female comic book characters who have been injured, killed, or depowered as a plot device within various superhero comic books. But it was coined by writer Gail Simone. She was referring to an incident in Green Lantern number 54, in which the title hero comes home to his apartment to find that his girlfriend has been killed and stuffed into the refrigerator.
Oh,
so it literally started
with
a girl stuffed into a refrigerator. And then Simone and her colleagues just developed a list of other fictional female characters who had been killed in particular ways that treated the female character merely as a device to move the male character's story arc forward rather than as a fully developed character in her own right. Again, which is what we see kind of differently in Red Rising. She is a full character. Yes, she does die two or three chapters in, but she still becomes a full character that has a lot of agency within the story to cause and effect change.
Cool. Yeah. If something's going to happen to your character, it should develop that character.
Yeah, it should be for a reason.
Yeah.
What's our cause for this week?
Our cause for the week is AmeriCorps.
Ooh.
Yes. And you and I actually know someone who went through the AmeriCorps program.
We do.
Jack Reed. And I know that he loved it. He went back a couple different times. AmeriCorps is a national program. It is done through the U.S. government, the United States government. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a couple different arms of it. The AmeriCorps State National supports a wide range of local service programs that engage thousands of Americans in intensive community service each year. they provide grants to a network of local and national organizations and agencies committed to using national service to address critical community needs in education, public safety, health, and the environment. Each of these organizations and agencies, in turn, use their AmeriCorps funding to recruit, place, and supervise AmeriCorps members nationwide. This is an amazing program.
Yeah, they're really cool. And I know Jack has learned so much and gained so much from doing it. It's amazing.
They're teaching schools in the inner cities. They're going into places that people are not necessarily wanting to go into. And mm-hmm. they are changing the world.
His profile picture is always him and a really cute kid reading a book.
Yeah.
It's the best.
It's so sweet. You can find out more about AmeriCorps at nationalservice.gov/programs/AmeriCorps.
The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on all your favorite social media sites at UMPBOH, even our own website, UMPBOH.com.
You can also find us on Patreon at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. Right there, through that very website, mm-hmm. you can help us make this podcast happen every single week. Listener participation is so big. You know, we love talking to you on the Facebook. So come talk to us on Patreon as well.
And we couldn't make any of this happen without our amazing production team. So a special shout out to Dan,
Steph,
Olivia,
Jeanette,
Kim,
Ashley,
and Sydney.
And our new intern, Vic.
Woo!
Yes.
Go, Vic, go.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done. That's a quote from a Muppet movie. I can't remember which one, but there's some Muppet looking through his pocket and he's like, I have a blackberry, a blueberry, raspberry, Halle Berry. It's so funny. What did you call me? An innocent being of light?
An innocent ray of light.
An innocent ray of light. I mean, you're not wrong.
No.